Hello, this is Bigfoot Speaks. I'm Dylan. I'm joined by Jillian. Hi. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce your last name.
It's Trebilcock. Hi, Dylan. Very kind. Yeah. Lovely to be here with you.
Good to have you on here. You said you had a few questions you wanted to ask or a topic in mind.
I actually asked you, do you have any questions?
Sorry.
Want me to ask, but look, I'm really happy to talk about, I'm interested in your theory about prisoners as slaves. I think that's something that needs to be discussed, if you're interested in speaking about it.
Sure. What's it all?
How's my mic sounding? Is my mic loud enough now? Better now. It's okay, I've got it sorted. Yeah, sorry, go on.
What specifically about it?
Well, it's true, isn't it? What do you know about the prison system? Like, you know, it seems that a lot of the cannon fodder in life is from the working classes. They deliberately go around, the army goes around collecting poor people, and poor people are attracted to the security of, you know, the free training and the free security, especially if you come from extreme poverty. And also, you know, the sentences that poor people get compared to wealthy people in the court system is quite ridiculous. Like, someone can get 5 years for raping a whole lot of children, and someone else can get 5 years for stealing a motor car.
Mm-hmm. It's an unproportionate system. It's an unproportionate justice system. Because what happens is people are sent to jail for longer than their crime justifies, because they get you on micro crimes, nonviolent mostly. And they do it because they want your free labor.
Well, that's a really interesting statement or claim, Dylan, and I'd like you to extrapolate on, you know, talk a little bit more about that. Where do you get that sort of, I agree with you, but let's just talk about the evidence.
For example, there was somebody recently who is facing a life sentence for making pot brownies.
For making, marijuana brownies, yeah.
Yes, a life in prison.
What?
Life.
Did they want more in jail? Just extraordinary.
And that's really not a one in a million. That's the norm. I mean, there was a guy, somebody who got sentenced to 20 years. I forget what the exact crime was, but I'm pretty sure it was a marijuana possession. And it seems to be all these, the war on drugs that created the prison industrial complex.
And that's right. And so what you just said is, you just said that you think it seems to be the war on drugs that created the industrial prison complex.
Mm-hmm.
How do you trace that back?
So we have the largest prison population on the planet, more than Iran, more than China, and China has 10 times our population.
The Chinese have a different system. The ancient Confucius theory of justice, this is an ancient, you know, Confucian one, was that you make a light sentence and you use such a strong moral force that you create an impression on the person that they want to change for the better. So it's actually the responsibility is in the ancient sort of Confucian system was that you become a model to the person and that they want to adapt to your more ethical ways. And so you treat them ethically.
I believe the war on drugs was started under the Ronald Reagan administration.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Reagan, Carter, or Bush Sr. I'm not sure.
Go on. It's been around a long time, drug dealing and money, though, and people making money out of drug dealing, that's for sure.
If the CIA does it, though, no problem.
Yeah.
And then there are contracts made with companies like I just pulled up an article on it. Corrections Corporations of America and GEO Group operate detention centers that cash in on people, that cash in on the inmates. And companies like people like Henry Widell and all these huge corporations, I'm sure Monsanto gets in on it. I'm sure the defense contractors get in on it. But they all do this.
Mm. So it's big business.
Yeah, big business took over and created the prison industrial complex, just like they created the military industrial complex.
It's really tragic, isn't it? And that people haven't found a way to, it's like a new fight for freedom.
Yeah, and you could even go to some of the judges. There was a judge who makes his cash off of putting children away for decades for this prison industrial complex.
Oh.
You can find confessions from some of those judges online. There have been plenty of arrests of judges. I mean, this isn't a conspiracy theory. This is fact.
And look, sorry. Go on.
That's all I had. It was that it sucked.
Yeah, it's totally and utterly sick. I want to Google something too about it then, because it's very interesting. You're right. So many conspiracy theories doesn't mean that the theory doesn't then become a fact, because there's, we're rife with conspiracies. And, you have to have a theory before you have the fact. So it's like a conspiracy fact, because it is a conspiracy. It's a total conspiracy. If you're putting children, I want to see one of those documents, Dylan. Can you get the link, or should I just Google judge putting children away? What should I Google, and I'll quickly Google it.
Type into Google child pipeline. The child pipelines to jail, basically, is what they are. I don't know exactly what you type.
That'll do.
I haven't got it.
What is the school-to-prison pipeline? And this is a good one. Fact sheet, how bad is the school-to-prison pipeline? That looks like a good one. March 28, 2003. Even Wikipedia has it. The term school-to-prison pipeline is a phrase that is used by education reform. And that's different. Huh?
Well, I was reading a story recently about a kid who got put in there for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Got put in a mini prison, but they were still used as slave labor.
Yeah. The school-to-prison pipeline refers to the policies and practices that push our nation's school children, especially our most at-risk children, out of classrooms and into the juvenile and prison and criminal justice systems. This pipeline reflects the prioritization of incarceration over education for growing, and that's a really important sentence, isn't it? The prioritization of incarceration over education, because children's frontal lobes aren't even like scientifically, they've proven that frontal lobes aren't even developed until you're 25, 26. It just so happens this is an interesting topic because when I studied to be a youth worker many, many years ago, I got placed, and because I had a strong personality, they kept putting me in bloody prisons, which was the last place I really wanted to be. But anyway, I ended up in a children's prison. The children, it was called Baltara, and it was in Parkville in Melbourne, Australia, which is where I come from. And there was a little boy there. This is, you know, and before that, from 0 to 10, they went to a centre called a Lambie. And so a lot of children would end up in these places for various reasons that the so-called social workers deemed, you know, for the protection of the children. But the abuse that went on in those places was extreme. And this particular prison, Baltara, which is definitely a prison, the children actually had were in cells, right? We're talking about little kids in cells there.
Yeah.
It was horrendous. And one day there was this creep of a man. His name was Mr. Ham. It might have been Ham Wall. I can't remember. Anyway, I'm very happy to name him. But Ham something, and he was the head of the Juvenile Justice, Baltara Juvenile Justice Centre, yeah. Whatever it was. This yeah. Lock.
Justice anyway. Probably in air quotes.
Yeah, exactly. And he there was a young Muslim boy there who had been, well, I'll say he was Muslim, but he was definitely, he was a Middle Eastern boy. I don't know what his religion was, actually. And he had been raped by his father. And so he'd ended up in the system for being raped, and then this creep of a man was intimidating him, and this boy was obviously emotionally damaged, and he belittled the boy in front of the whole courtyard and then sent him to his cell, and I went to his cell, and I don't know how I opened the door, but I did. I opened the door and went in there, and he was biting himself. You know, he'd bitten holes in him, not holes, but big teeth marks all over himself and torn his clothes. Like, we're talking about a 10-year-old boy who's, you know, been sexually abused, his sister was sexually abused, and then he ends up being intimidated by this creep of a man. God knows whatever happened to that boy. I just, you know, I never really found out.
Those are horror stories that you hear all the time about the prison industrial complex. There's another one, probably the one that I know pretty well, actually. There was a kid who made a stupid comment online. It was very idiotic of him, especially since it was just after Sandy Hook. And he was locked away for 25 years. 25.
For what? Why was he locked away for 25 years?
For making a joke, but it was taken as a threat.
I'm sorry, I have to laugh.
Yeah, it's hard not to.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Like, it's unbelievable that people can be so insane and get away with such insanity.
Well, yeah, the kid thankfully got out after 5 years, but the kid was physically and emotionally scarred, which is, I think, how most people come out of that. If they don't come out scarred, they come out criminals.
Mm.
So it's like a never-ending monster, just like the military-industrial complex. The prison-industrial complex takes innocent people, puts them in prison, and if they don't come out mentally scarred, they come out a criminal. Once again, then they go back, and it keeps feeding the system. The never-ending supply.
Mm. And you don't have to be incredibly smart to work that out. And yet, there it is still the system.
Yeah, it's just basic logic.
Mm.
But that's how it works.
Mm. So, you know, this is where you and I were speaking about this yesterday, Dylan. Like, can you teach people to be logical or can't you? This was the big question we were coming up with yesterday. And look, you must be able to teach power. You know, on the one hand, you can say some people are naturally smart and naturally open-minded and curious, and other people are more sort of gullible. But there's got to be a way there. We still, people can be educated. People can be taught to think.
Absolutely. But Like I had said on that show yesterday, it depends on the person. Not everybody can be taught logic. Not everybody can be taught reasoning.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that people should just give up on it entirely. There are plenty of people willing to learn.
Yeah, well, there's matters of degrees, and every shot is... Yeah, I really think that logic and reasoning and ethics, and the logic and reasoning of ethics, such as, you know, virtue ethics and bioethics and utilitarian ethics and different sorts of ethics, should actually be taught in schools.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly shouldn't be flooding the prison system.
Well, it, as you said, it's a form of slavery. So who makes the money out of this, Dylan? Because it's the old story, follow the money.
Yeah, well, the people who gain the cash out of it are the people who contract these prisons. See, how it works is the prisons will tell you, you have to have this number of people in your prison at all times, or you lose funding.
Right.
So, they pay X amount of money. They get a stake in the prison under the condition that the prison is always kept alive, that there's always somebody there to fill the void.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, Dylan, I'm multitasking here.
That's fine. But that's really all there is to it. It's an incredibly simple concept. It's just so well hidden.
Well, this is the thing, and it's something that we need to wake up to, and it's really important to have the conversation, to have the conversation. I was horrified when I heard that prisons were privatized, because it's not that long ago that they were privatized in Australia.
They're like, privatized in all Western civilizations now.
You know, it's just sort of... This is why I really believe in direct democracy. I think that, you know, the people need to take their power back. Like, I think there's so many different ways that we can take our powers back from the government. And one of them is citizen-initiated referendum. But then again, then I think about it, you know, one of the big arguments that's going about that, people, you know, having more say in their government, is that you'll get, you know, like a whole lot of redneck dumbwits voting for terrible things. So that is one of the arguments against citizens' initiated referendum, but it does work in countries like Switzerland, where the people run a very pretty good country. It's something you don't know about, probably, but it's something I'm quite excited about. But, you know, all the different ways. I was listening to somebody on People's Internet Radio, which is where I work. I better put a plug in for them, where I have my show. And Dylan,
you can find me on there now as well.
Pardon?
I was just letting the audience know that they could find me there as well now.
Yeah, Dylan is on peoplesinternetradio.com. And I've forgotten what I was saying, because I'm very good at forgetting what I was saying.
So am I. Don't worry.
We could have fun.
Yeah, we can. So we talked about this briefly last night.
Yeah.
There's a tie-in here, though. The Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah.
It's another form of slavery. It increases the power of the prison industrial complex.
That's what I was trying to say. There's many ways to approach this giant. Somebody was saying on People's Internet Radio on an earlier show, one of the guests was saying, oh yes, look, the way to dismantle this thing is from the bottom. And there is that grassroots sort of approach, you know, where people become informed. But I actually... At this time in my life, you know, this week or this month, I'm of the opinion that you approach it from every direction. You don't just approach it from bottom up. You approach it from top down. You approach it from the side, like whichever way, you know. Like if you, you know, you dismantle this sort of ignorance from 100, as many directions as you can, because whatever way you can put the light into a situation, let's just put the light in.
Yeah, people just need to wake up to the truth about it. And the prison industrial complex is a symptom of the corruption. That's all it is. It's just a symptom.
It's a symptom of the corruption. Yeah, it's a part of it. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, if judges and politicians weren't allowed to take legalized bribes, there would be no military-industrial complex. There would be no war on drugs. There would be no prison-industrial complex.
What are you calling legalized bribes?
What do I call legalized bribes? Legalized bribes are really unlimited campaign donations by people, or by corporations. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, if they can get you to, if they can give you, say, $1 million, which they can, and then say, all right, you work for us. This is what you did. This is what you do, or we cut off your funding.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not how it should work.
Yeah. Is that your dog?
Yeah.
I've got the loudest dog. You wouldn't believe how loud my dog is. What sort of a dog have you got?
Lab.
Ah, yeah. He's a big, grody one. Yeah, black or gold?
Black.
Yeah, I imagine it was black. Okay, so back to where we were. So, where were we, Dylan? For the dog, right?
The legalized bribery.
Yeah, well, I've forgotten. I'm good at this.
Yeah, everyone does something.
Women are meant to be better at multitasking than men, but I wonder. I don't know about that one.
But what I was saying was that the legalized bribes are campaign donations.
Yeah.
Unlimited total.
Yeah, I was thinking about the mafia and you know, I mean, even there's probably why JFK was shot, really.
I would have to disagree that he was shot by the mafia.
Oh, who do you think shot him?
I don't know who did it, but next.
Oh, I interviewed his girlfriend. I actually have an interview somewhere with. Not JFK, with Ruby. You know Ruby, who was shot?
Yeah. No, Ruby was
Oswald,
shot.
Oswald.
Yeah.
I did an interview with Stephen Roberts with Oswald's
girlfriend.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to be doing a JFK show eventually. All right. In the upcoming weeks, hopefully.
I can probably get this girl for you. She pretty well knows what's going on. It was with Stephen Roberts. Get it from Stephen Roberts. He'll give you the contact.
Oh.
And she lives in a fairly isolated sort of place, but the JFK anniversary of his death, she came out and spoke about it, and definitely, that fellow who shot JFK, was forced into doing it, and he knew he was going to be killed, and he told her.
I think he was completely innocent.
Who? Harvey Oswald?
Yeah.
I don't know whether his gun actually worked.
Is Oswald's girlfriend, is the one you're talking about, Judith?
Yeah.
Barry Baker?
Yeah. Yeah, Judith Baker, that's her. You got a comment you don't want to make about that?
No, I was just curious who it was.
That's who it was, with Judith Baker. Yeah. She had a lot to say for a few weeks. around that time, and basically she said that he knew he was set up. He was in cahoots with a guy called Ruby, that they were, was all mafia-driven, and that I don't think that gun was even fired, so he didn't actually do the shooting. I think it did come from the way the bullet went into his head and blew the back of his head off and everything, and there was a plastic surgeon that was hired who was also a part of this same sort of rat pack sort of mafiosa sort of thing. The back of his head was blown off, which meant it came from not from Harvey Oswald's direction, and they hired a very expensive, a very well-known mortician, and then there was the story of the mortician's girlfriend, which I either interviewed her or watched a YouTube clip. I can't remember now. I've been doing too many interviews.
I've listened to some of her stuff. I'm not sure how much I buy her story, but it's certainly interesting.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, I know it was the father, wasn't it, I think? It was the step, the daughter, and or the wife, and yeah, it was the wife, yeah. And all of a sudden, they had to run away straight after he stuck him back together, right? He went to JFK, he stuck him back together, then, because he was a fabulous mortician, so that nobody could tell that it was the back of the head that was blown out. Then they went and drove a very, very long way, and then they got a phone call as soon as Lee Harvey Oswald was shot, and then they went, right, he said, okay, we can go home. They were staying in a motel, and he said, it's safe now, and they all went back home again.
Jillian.
Yep.
Do you mind if I bring in a friend of mine? He's a JFK researcher. Do you mind if I pull him in?
I'd love it. Do you mind if I quickly just go and open the door for a second? So just speak with him for a sec. And just give me 30 seconds.
All right. Randy, can you pull in Chuck?
I'll just fill the air for a minute while we're waiting for Chuck.
Let's see. I can add him.
Yeah, but anyway, so that... Go on, sorry.
No, I added him in. He's okay. Just got it. I don't know if he can join.
Liberty... Yeah, he's still looking. Oh, he's got an eye too. Hey, that's hilarious. Because I only just stuck that eye up the other day because I lost my picture. Yeah, Chuck, we want you. There he is.
Hey, Chuck.
Ah, there we go. All right. No problem. I just need to stop the stream I was listening to.
So, we were just talking about Judith Barry Baker. I know that's one of your favorite topics.
I spent an hour yesterday on my show on another network talking about this already.
I have spoken with her, and I'm a very gullible person.
Sorry, go ahead. I wasn't trying to interrupt.
No. No, I'm saying I felt that everything she said made a fair bit of sense on the interview that we did with her. But I am gullible. So
see, it does make sense. Interesting because she got introduced to the public. Mostly people recognize her from Nigel Turner's series, The Men Who Killed Kennedy. She was actually the focus of an episode called The Love Affair. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not familiar with anything. I don't even know how I ended up on radio interviewing all these fascinating people. I just learn as I go along. So tell me more.
Well, that's okay. Her story first came to light in the JFK literature in about 96, I think it was, when a two-volume set came out sort of telling this story about her being Lee Harvey Oswald's mistress. And this is a fascinating story and something that I thought was interesting at first. However, I have watched over the years as her story has evolved, and it seems to evolve every time a new piece of research comes out. She's very adept at writing. She's an excellent writer and actually writes fiction. Didn't succeed with her fiction writing previous to this, but has succeeded with her book Me and Lee, as far as I'm concerned. Now, this is kind of a controversial stance regarding revisionist history, let's just say, in this subject area, but it's one of those things, you know. It is compelling, though, and it seems interesting. And now she has a new book out, actually, about David Ferry, who's another character from New Orleans at that time, who was tied to Oswald as well. So,
So tell me more about it. Can you write? Can you just tell everybody else, and I'll just have to be in a hole for a minute because I have these headsets and I have to go and open the door. The dog wants to go out, so. I'll just be back in a minute. You two talk amongst... It's a dog's day, radio day today. Because Dylan had a problem with his dog too. Hang on. I'll be back. Can you just give me 1 minute, 30 seconds?
Yes. Not a problem. Not a problem at all. Dylan's quite familiar with the fact that sometimes my dog winds up barking on the air too.
Sometimes your kid too.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I had my son on the air for a little bit at one point too, but... anyway, yeah, and it is kind of fascinating. This is one of the things we keep talking about doing, Dylan. One of these days we will have to just devote an entire show to the mythology around the case. Of course, one of those things that I consider to be absolute mythology is the Baker story. The only thing that there's actually historical proof for, as far as I'm concerned, is that she did actually work in one of the very same places that the historical Lee Harvey Oswald did have a temporary job, which, of course, was at the at the coffee company there in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So,
but she
Dylan, you,
also,
go ahead.
She did consider herself, or, you know, sort of, you've read it, to be quite a bright woman that was being employed to do something with her brain.
More right. Something
with her intelligence.
Yeah, she apparently was pretty skilled as a young person in high school regarding chemistry and apparently doing research on lab animals and this kind of thing. It depends on where the, you know, I'll just give you her end of the story, is that she was working on a cure for cancer because her grandmother had it and things like that, and she was personally doing that before she even graduated high school. And then she had been recruited by, of all people, Alton Ochsner, who was the head of the National Cancer Institute and all this other stuff at the time. And that's kind of fascinating. But...
Yeah.
But here's where the strangeness comes in. She spends part of her time in New Orleans there, just during this very not even the entire time that Lee Harvey Oswald is in New Orleans, but during part of the time that that Oswald returns to New Orleans, which was his hometown, and then claims to have been involved with everybody from Jack Ruby to David Ferry to Guy Bannister.
This is how we got there, because this is where we went. We were doing a segue from the mafia and sort of financial corruption in the prison system to Kennedy. Don't know how we went there, but we did. So keep going.
Well, yeah, no problem. You know, here's another thing that, due to a lot of the things that were revealed by the Church Committee in the 70s and also some of the stuff that was studied by the House Select Committee in the later part of that same decade, people have this impression, and there is quite a bit of literature devoted to the idea that the Italian mafia had possibly pulled off the hit on JFK. And, the logical question that anybody could ask here is, why then would the U.S. government and all of its agencies take their time to do anything but throw the Italian mafia under the bus in later years? Instead, they've participated in a cover-up more than half a century old now. You know, so... Again, I'm one of these guys who doesn't subscribe much to the whole mob did it theory on this. However, there is a reasonable argument when people try to say that there were mob people that were involved in a lot of assassinations and a lot of very dirty business in other countries and the United States.
Mostly because the CIA and the mafia are interchangeable depending on the day.
Well, yeah, see, that's the thing. The CIA will hire criminals anywhere, whether it's on U.S. soil or in other countries, and they really don't discriminate. So Sicilian mob could have just as easily been hired as Yakuza, as French Connection guys, as, you know, so on and so on and so on. So it's not outside of the realm of possibility that there were some, you know, say guys with vowels at the ends of their name that were probably involved on some cursory level with the assassination. But to say that they were the masterminds behind this, or to say that they were the key players, I very much doubt it. You know.
Yeah.
But this is one of those things where, you know, it's not something that I can get into really, really quickly and easily, but I'll tell you what, when it comes to discussing the interchangeable sort of criminal enterprises here and the, you know, the supposedly government-sanctioned criminals versus the, you know, organized crime, the nefarious characters that are outside of government circles, the lines become extremely blurred when we start talking about drugs, when we start talking about the prisons, when we start talking about anything, just about even the actual overthrows of foreign governments as perpetrated by the American CIA. Mm-hmm. And, of course, MI5 and MI6 are always involved in this kind of nonsense as well, aren't they?
They have to be.
Yeah, but well, the thing that we were that we were sort of working out, I'm just choosing a song that you might like to play called "Throw Me Under the Bus." I'm just going to put it in chat here for you. I'll just put it in here for your producer. There it is. I interviewed this guy too, Joe Peskin. It's quite a good song. There it is. If you want to play it, it's called "Throw Me Under the Bus." The thing that we're truly that fascinates me about what you were saying, Chuck and Dylan, is it's like the power of an open question. You know, do you ever really get? There's always, when you think you've got an answer, then there's another question. And so what you're saying here is that Judith Baker sort of stories seem to be a little bit creative rather than factual, and they keep on shifting.
Well, right, but I mean, there's plenty of people that have, you know, sort of confabulated, I like to use that word, I don't even know if it's a real word, but have sort of confabulated their, you know, their narratives in a way to integrate, you know, known facts along with their very cursory sort of involvement in things. The possibility that she ran into Oswald and worked at the Riley Coffee Company, like I said, is very good. The payroll records reveal that, and it seems as though, you know, she could have run into him. But to have carried on this this entire relationship and to be involved in all the things that she's talking about, just, you know, if you just take them on the surface, you know, to involve somebody who is just barely out of high school in all this stuff. And remember, Oswald was only 24 when he died as well. She basically also gives him certain attributes that we know are historically rather difficult to swallow as well. You know, a guy who was supposed to be completely fluent in Russian, that could barely write in his own language. If you take a look at documents that were written by him, if you take a look at even what he calls his historic diary, which is not historic or a diary by any means, but this is his, you know, supposed journalistic writing, you find all sorts of very simple mistakes that are made throughout that in his own native language that seem rather odd. Now, when you look at the linguistic difference between Russian and English, you almost wonder how it is that someone who could barely communicate in their own written language could be fluent in such a linguistically diverse language like Russian. You know, it's almost like, well, gee, I can't really speak English very well, but I can write and speak Arabic just fine, even though I was never born there and I just happened to pick that up, you know,
yeah,
on my own.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, interesting, Charles. Well, I can never reach a conclusion on a lot of things. So you've got me wondering You've got me wondering again now. Good pick, Dylan.
Well, you know, but that's the thing about something that's taken, you know, half a century to you know, unfold in a way. There are various schools of thought on it at this point, and you know, and I caution everybody always to think for yourselves and to look at not only the official stories but the revisionist stories with the most critical of eyes, because there is often. You know, there are lies in the official stories, and we know this. This is something that, you know, generally anybody who runs in these kind of circles agree upon. But to let other fairy tales infiltrate when we're searching for the truth, in a lot of cases, I find to be even more harmful because, you know, I would truly love to believe her story. I really would. It's just that there are so many inconsistencies with the reality.
Yeah.
What's that?
Plot holes.
Yeah, basically plot holes in the narrative. And then even if you just consider with, like I said, with her new piece of literature, which I haven't read yet, I have to be honest, but if you consider that she devotes...
too much.
Well, if you consider that she has 500 pages on a guy that she claims to have known for a couple of months, you know, again, how much of that is, you know, sensible in your mind? You know what I mean? And I question whether she actually ever ran into David Ferry. I question a lot of stuff. And it's possible that, there are some elements of truth written into her story. It's a possibility. But I think at this point, it has been exacerbated with so much fiction that it would be near impossible to sort out unless she wants to make a deathbed confession, in my opinion.
Nice segue there.
Thank you. But sorry, and it's funny because Dylan wanted me to come in on this because he knows it's one of those subjects that actually has really aggravated me over the years.
Chuck, I love aggravating you.
I know you do. No, but sorry, I got away from the main point there, which was all about the you know, how the different corporate interests and criminal interests seem to be so intermingled with one another that you know, that sometimes it's very hard to sort out, you know, who's actually wearing the black hat and who's wearing the white hat and so on and so forth, isn't it?
Chuck, we definitely have to do the Smiths show eventually.
Absolutely, you're going to be brilliant. Oh, doesn't matter. Go on.
What's your opinion on what we were discussing before we got to Kennedy?
You know, that's the funny part. I kind of walked away, so I wasn't sure what was going on. I was taking care of some things personally, and then I came back and heard that, and I said, "Oh, okay." So I sent you a little message telling you that I was laughing.
Yeah, I loved that. I didn't even know who it was at first. I didn't even know that we were talking about Baker for a second.
Well, she also mentioned another thing there about the mortician.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a story that again originates with the Nigel Turner series, and I'm pretty sure that was in the episode called Smoking Guns. See, there's actually 9 parts to this series, which originated with the BBC, and only 6 parts of it exist now for resale. Because the last 3 were actually deleted from the set. And, of course, part 7, 8, and 9. Part 7 is Judy Baker's part, or maybe it's part 8. I forget which order it goes in now. But one of the other parts was all about this this interesting story of this mortician who was apparently really brilliant with reconstructing individuals that had been, you know, say, with gunshot wounds and things like that. And... this is also part of one of those, you know, now redacted kind of things that's out there. You know, that story, interesting.
It's a false story, too?
No, I wouldn't say that that's a false story, but it's kind of dodgy because, of course, we have the guys, you know, is dead and all this other stuff. Obviously, some people were involved with each other in Dallas because Dallas was a small city at that point in time.
Yeah.
A lot smaller than it is today. And everybody kind of knew everybody in Dallas. So, it's very possible that that guy was involved with something, but since we have a really reasonable sort of understanding of exactly how Kennedy's body was transferred, where it was moved to, and who worked on it, I would say that that the guy that they identify as possibly working on Kennedy's body there probably did not. Because we know actually who did the work now. We know who had to hold his head together and everything else afterwards. And a lot of misconceptions about what happened to Kennedy's body have been cleared up over time, let's just say.
How do we know this?
What's that?
How do we know this?
Well, when I compare the official records along with interviews of eyewitnesses that that we know were there, that can be proved photographically were there, that can be proved by multiple overlapping records were there, etc. I assume that the basic chain of custody outside of the time that the Secret Service had the casket to themselves on Air Force One, outside of that particular time period, we know exactly where the body was and what was going on with it. There is some discrepancy regarding, of course, the autopsy, because, well, at Bethesda, they had locked it down. So there was a really strange scene. And if you ever want to study something that's mind-bending, you ought to really just study what happened just during that autopsy alone. The individuals that were checked in and out of that room and everything else are insane. So, you know, it's something to be beheld. And even when you look at, you know, guys like Jay Humes and Jay Thornton Boswell and Pierre Fink, who showed up late at the autopsy, who was called in, he was the only guy who had any sort of business dealing with gunshot wounds at the time. You know, and then you look at the official record, and they have been thoroughly, you know, thoroughly kind of grilled by various bodies of individuals and researchers over the years. You kind of get an assembly of that story there that just it never stops giving regarding the strange things that went on regarding Kennedy's body post assassination. So.
I don't want to take over your show, Dylan. You should lead him where you want him to go. But if I can't shut myself up, I have to say, tell me some of it now. Please, Charles.
Well, I don't know. You know, Dylan, is this where you want to go? I mean,
we've got 12 minutes. We've only got 12 minutes left, so screw it.
Yeah, but it's your show, brother. So, you know, you tell me. You know,
We're going to have to do a two-hour special on this one of these days, but yeah, you can keep going.
Alrighty then. Well, we have the a theory that that was first put forth by David Lifton, I would say, in the book Best Evidence, about the possibility of body alteration, because the witnesses at Arklan Hospital in Dallas do not report the same wounds that are recorded at the autopsy regarding the gunshots to Kennedy's body, right? So this is a good place to start. There is a reason for this, but of course Lifton in his investigation came up with the fact that the body had been taken out of one casket and put into another casket, and therefore felt as though a completely empty casket had been shipped to Bethesda Medical Center in Maryland for the official autopsy. Now, there's also anecdotal evidence about a chase regarding the Navy hearse, the Great Navy hearse, which is most famously photographed with Jackie Kennedy entering and sitting in at the time that the body arrived there in D.C. And there's another vehicle that pulls up, which is a black hearse, which people did not understand for many years. This was from the funeral home so that they could do restorative work on Kennedy's body. And you had to actually dig those records out of, I think it was Gawler's funeral home, in order to put that whole thing together. So, of course, that's post-autopsy stuff. Here's an interesting little factoid that really wasn't brought out until recent years, and that is that the Bethesda Hospital, the way it was set up in the loading dock where Kennedy's body should have been loaded into within this giant ornamental casket, which was kind of hastily grabbed in Dallas at the time, the same funeral home that Aubrey Reich worked for. I think it was O'Neill's. And they had difficulty getting that thing into Air Force One. They had difficulty getting it into the back loading dock at Bethesda because, quite honestly, there's a geometric problem. And that door, which they were trying to bring it through, was actually designed to handle what was called a shipping casket at that time. So they probably transferred Kennedy's body to a shipping casket to get him in the door, which is something that they really didn't want known at the time. So there's this weird sort of shell game with these caskets and everything else. And, of course, the postscript on that is also bizarre because Bobby Kennedy, utilizing his insider kind of connections in government, turned around and wound up dumping that ornamental casket at sea, and we didn't see those documents until 1999, I think.
Hey, guys, this is off topic, but I just got sent an article about another White House fence jumper.
Oh, well. That's always fun. Of course, Secret Service complicity in the whole thing is a rather interesting topic as well. But
I guess we can always find a segue back to JFK with your junk.
This is what the problem is with me, yes, Dylan. you know, look, you spend 25 years researching something, and this is what happens. So I'm sorry, but
no,
there it is.
It's all good. I find it kind of funny.
Listen, I can't find a connection, though, for today's attack on the Canadian Parliament. So,
God.
You know, at least not that far. But nearly anything else, I can get it, you know.
So,
you know, if you want, it looks like we could actually go longer if you want, Dylan.
Yeah, yeah, we can probably go another 30 minutes. I'm actually going to have to go at the 9:30 mark. So we can definitely go another half hour.
Okay. Yeah, I can say.
All right. You good, Chuck?
Sure, why not? So back to the body and everything else. Like I said, there's the official autopsy that was, you know, sort of released, you know, via the Warren Commission, which consisted mainly of a face sheet, which was really poorly filled out. Anyone who is a forensic pathologist who has ever examined this thing in later years has stated that this was probably the exemplar of what you do wrong regarding an autopsy. Physical measurements are absolutely unbelievable. For instance, the brain, which was weighed at the autopsy, weighs more than the normal adult male brain could possibly weigh. Now, if you just assume for a moment that some of it had been blasted out in Dealey Plaza, you would assume that it has to weigh a little less than the average male brain of a grown person, right? Okay. There were various other landmarks taken at the autopsy. Like, for instance, you're supposed to utilize things from the center of the body outward, and you're supposed to measure that way. They were using landmarks on the body like the tip of the mastoid as measured from where the bullet hole is and all of this other stuff, which is really unusual. And there is a lot of controversy, and finally admitted to in the mid-90s by J.J. Humes, who was the lead autopsist that night, that not only, as he had admitted in the Warren Commission, that he had burned his initial notes regarding the autopsy on Sunday morning, coincidentally right after Lee Harvey Oswald had been shot, but also he had burned his first draft of the autopsy report. Now, he stated that the reason for doing so.
What was the reason he said he burned them?
Because part of the paperwork had been soaked in Kennedy's blood, And he had... What's that?
It was a hilarious reason. Yeah, go on.
Oh, no, it gets even better. He states that this is something he stated several times on the record, by the way, that that he had once as a boy seen the chair that Lincoln had been shot in used as a center of morbid curiosity for display to the public, and therefore did not want his notes containing Kennedy's blood, et cetera, to become a sort of, you know, a sort of feature for morbid curiosity regarding the blood of a dead president, as did that chair Lincoln was in. Okay?
Yeah.
Kind of funny, though.
Excuse for him, yeah.
Yeah, kind of funny, though. A diagram drawn by Boswell, who was the second in command, basically, that night. Because these were two Navy pathologists, by the way, assisted by Pierre Fink, who was Army. But anyway... interesting that Boswell's stuff had also been included. Sorry, a diagram which is kind of confusing to this day had also been soaked in blood, and of course Humes did not get rid of that. It's still in the official record, even though it's spattered with Kennedy's blood. But, of course, he couldn't account for a lot of things. But he did, like I said, finally admit that not only, based on his testimony that he had given to the Warren Commission, that he had burned his initial notes, but he had burned the first draft of the autopsy. And it's my belief that he probably burned the second draft of the autopsy because it was being revised as events were unfolding. Because, like I said, Sunday morning is the day that Oswald took a bullet to the gut and also died. So... I don't think there was any need to support anything other than a lone gunman at that point, and there's a lot of strange things about this. I wish I was better prepared for discussing the medical evidence, but a lot of this stuff has become a little more publicly available since the release of the documents from the Assassination Records Review Board. In fact, if you look online at the AARC, I believe it is, archive, you'll find pretty much a complete set of the medical documents that are directly declassified by the Assassination Records Review Board. They actually had some of the witnesses to the autopsy and the participants in the autopsy take blank anatomical sheets and redraw things and everything else at that time. So, and there's even actually 3D pieces of bone and stuff that they and so
on. And I'm not typing to you. I'm typing to Liberty Media. Yeah, go on.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. I was just double-checking what was happening there.
No. I'll talk. Go on, Chuck.
I'm back.
Oh, welcome back, Bill.
So, like I said, I can go off in 100 different directions regarding this. So, if you guys want...
Conclusion, Chuck. So what's your conclusion? Let's go for a conclusion for a minute.
My conclusion ultimately is that it was elements of the intelligence agencies that ultimately colluded to basically get Kennedy out of the way. He was really pressing on the Central Intelligence Agency at that time, had absolutely issued an order in National Security Action Memorandum 263 that would have removed all U.S. personnel from Vietnam by the end of calendar year 1965, and he wanted the first 1,000 U.S. personnel, I believe it was, removed by the end of that year, which happened to be 1963. Now, that was written very shortly before his death. When you put this in perspective with the fact that we had just had the overthrow of the Vietnamese government in South Vietnam, the Diem and Nguyen brothers there, which was something where the CIA again disobeyed Kennedy's orders directly and essentially caused that assassination to occur, as we learned later by use of Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, believe it or not. which if you don't know who he was, well, he happened to be, you know, an interesting figure that's reoccurred in Kennedy's life. But, of course, you can easily find him as Nixon's running mate in the 1960 election.
Yes.
So, but anyway, there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on here regarding this, and the CIA to me is the most likely suspect regarding all this stuff. They had carried out assassinations like this throughout the world, and I think they pulled one off that day, and have basically distorted, twisted around, and paid various people to further distort and twist around the evidence ever after. I've got
headphones,
so I'm not sure who's feeding back through the speaker, but it's not me.
I don't have a link.
I've got headphones too.
Ah, Dylan, you got an open speaker?
Nah, I don't have a link, and I have headphones on.
Weird, then. Perhaps it's because I've hung it right around the neck of the CIA, and therefore we've got somebody's attention.
Wake up.
No, we don't have three chucks anymore.
Excellent. Well, I can't even handle that.
I don't think the world can.
You are correct again, sir. So where was I before we entered the echo chamber?
I don't know. That was so entertaining.
The truth is spoken three times. It must be true.
Yep, exactly. So look. It's okay. You guys are having an interesting conversation, though, regarding the prison industrial complex.
Add to that, Chuck?
Well, you know, all of these things, like I say, when you have the collusion between the ostensibly legitimate government and the corporate entities, which are corrupt in and of themselves, but then corrupt the government entities and the intelligence agencies kind of added into the mix. You know, you have this very strange synthesis of evil, essentially, in anything that's profitable. So there is no surprise that there is prison for profit in this country. We have the highest percentage of our population incarcerated, I believe, in this country than any other place in the world. And of course, you know, the labor that has been utilized in the prison systems, the exploitation of prisoners, the experimentation on prisoners, which has been documented slowly but surely over time. You know, this is just one of those systems that is so ripe for abuse. And by the way, you know, it's one of those things that is acquiesced to by the public rather easily, because after all, if they experiment on murder, destroy, or torture prisoners in a lot of cases, well, they were bad guys, so they sort of deserved it.
This is what's the problem with demonizing. This is exactly something that we really need to look at, actually. That's where people need to become conscious and pull that together.
It's a double standard is all it is.
Well, a double standard, how would you describe that double standard, Dylan?
Well, when Joseph Stalin puts people in labor camps, we go kill him because he's a bad dude, which he is. When the U.S. does it, we congratulate them for doing such a good job.
Yeah, well, what basically is happening there, I think, you know, there's a lot of ways that we can look at that. One of them is called internalizing the oppressor. You know, like we actually take that idea, and then we become that idea rather than having sort of a gap between us and the idea. Do you know what I mean? We no longer differentiate ourselves from the idea. We become the idea, even though we're anti it. It's like hanging murderers, like you're saying. And that really lacks a lot of investigation. You know, people just don't think what non-harmfulness actually means.
Well, you know, I'll say this, that there's selective enforcement. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I thought you were done.
No, well, I hadn't quite gone. I sort of began by saying not quite what I was thinking, because I was trying to find my way back to what I was thinking. So what I was thinking is that what happens when we do something like internalize the oppressor, and you know, when we have this double standard, which is the point I wanted to pull apart with Dylan, is that we we just lack that discrimination, and what I think a lot of it comes from is from a religious societies and a religious background. That we label something evil, and once we call it evil, then we can kill it, we can harm it. So we cause a schism within our personalities. Sort of, it's like, do you get what I'm saying? I'm saying we call it evil, and if it's evil, we can then destroy it. So it's really placed upon the label and the way in which we analyze the situation.
Ignorance and the appeal to authority are both the problem there, because in most cases when we discuss prisoners, we're not discussing them from the point of view of understanding what it is they've been imprisoned for. You know, there's usually no knowledge about that. But what I'm saying is it's sort of easily dismissed by the populace in a lot of cases, because they figure that if the authorities found them guilty, if the system nailed them, then they must be bad people who are worthy of being treated in less than a humane fashion. This is not always the case. I mean, I think that's what you're getting at, right?
Yes and no. I'm saying that it's a cycle within my own. You know, I often find the best way to deal with understanding other people's minds is understanding my own mind. You know, like seeing the aspects, the seeds in my own mind. So basically, if I demonize somebody, if I call it evil, then I've given myself carte blanche to harm it. Whereas if I look at it with a different perspective and go, all right, that person's just trying to find happiness. The way they're going about it is by raping this child. They're causing incredible suffering to the child. They're sowing incredible seeds of insanity within their own mind. But they are still trying to find happiness. They're just completely causing an incredible amount of suffering, so they're missing the mark. Then I can have more compassion for them, and I will have a calmer mind and a more clear mind about what's actually going on in the mind of that other person.
Something you want to add to, Dylan?
I did have something, but I forget now.
Dylan and I. That's why we've got you, Chuck, is Dylan and I. Can't remember things.
That's okay. I'm one of the oldest known cases, you know, that I know of in my world, just my world, mind you, of ADD. So it's okay, not a problem.
I think we're all ADD.
That's why we get along.
Yeah, lateral thinkers, I call it. It's good for sort of a loose sort of rave. But anyway, the point that I'm making is, I think that's how we need to analyze things, you know, because we do that just in our ordinary relationships, you know, like if somebody yells at you and is abusive to you and or says something actually personally insulting, and they don't normally do that, you could go, okay, so they're upset to the point that they've become a personally insulting, or you can go, oh, they're really nasty. How dare they do that? You know what I mean? And when you go into the position of how dare they do that, or I don't understand how you could do that, then we're building our mind in the direction of not understanding. And, you know, if you choose to not understand something, then how can you understand it? And therefore, how can you be wise? you know, to be wise, we have to suspend a lot of judgments and just analyze. That doesn't mean that we give away our morals or our integrity, for want of a better word, because moral is a subjective sort of experience. But that doesn't mean we throw away our ability to analyze a situation. But I just think that's the thing that I've noticed, particularly in Christian and even in Buddhist and Muslim societies, where we put this sort of this right and wrong overlay on it rather than... I'll segue halfway through the sentence. Did you know the word sin originally means to miss the mark? So say you've got a target and a bow and arrow, right, and you want to get a bullseye or you want to hit the target. If you miss the target, you sin. That's where the word sin comes from. So then you have to analyze, okay, so what is the mark, right? If there's a mark, what is the mark? Well, the mark is to attain some sort of happiness, obviously. I mean, because that's what... we're all trying to do is we're all trying to find different, you know, how to have a peaceful, have a happy life and a happy mind. So if by harming somebody I cause agitation in my own mind, then I have missed the mark and therefore I have sinned. But what we have done with the original meaning of the word sin is we have twisted it back into pathologizing and demonizing and into good and bad.
Well, right, but at the same time, you know, one who harms someone else but attains their own happiness, what would you call that then, you know?
Somebody who harms somebody else but attains their own happiness. Mm-hmm. I'd still call it stupid. Yeah. They've still missed the mark because I don't believe that innately people can harm others and attain happiness. We may attain some sort of temporary happiness, but because on an underlying level, my inner peace, because we're taking this into a spiritual dimension here, right, because that's why we're using the word sin and stuff, because my inner good heart, you know, my humanity, like, you know, we've got dogs, we've got pets, we know that animals relate to each other with a feelingness, you know. So if we're talking about a serious harm, you know, like a deep harm, then I don't think you get inner peace from doing that.
Well, I'll tell you something. If you you probably never interacted with a true sociopath then, because you want to see something that absolutely doesn't match any of what you're talking about there. I mean, there are all sorts of diversions from that in this world.
A sociopath actually has a highly developed false self, which is an authentic self. They develop a secondary self, which is a false self, but underneath that, they still do have an authentic self, but they just don't relate to it in any way. In an obvious way.
Yeah, well, that's a guarantee, because I've actually spent time face-to-face with people that seem to have no care in the world for whatever it is they do to others, yeah. You know, and it is a rather interesting, chilling experience to see someone who seems to absolutely be devoid of any sort of empathy whatsoever. So,
yeah, no, completely right. But I think that can be grown. Yeah, go on, Dylan, sorry.
Do you want to... we still have some time. I thought we were... Okay, I thought we were done for some reason.
No, we got about 16 minutes according to my clock.
Awesome.
Just to be vague.
Awesome.
Anything you want to add to this, Dylan?
I've never really interacted with a sociopath, so I don't have a lot to add to this discussion.
Okay. That's just one example, you know. I'm being told 13 minutes, but all right, that's fine.
Where did we come from that we got into that sort of evil and sin? And where were we when we segued?
I probably struck a chord with you when I used the word evil to describe something, and I can't recall what it is now. I think that's what happened.
I can't remember either. That seems to happen a lot.
Yeah, well, again, you know, attention deficit theater, as it was stated in chat there. So, alrighty then.
Yeah.
I can't find chat. I can't find chat. Where have you found the chat, Charles?
The Skype chat.
Oh, our chat. Oh, somebody wrote it there. Oh, I didn't look. Oh, I see.
But there's also a chat on TLBTownCrier.com that comes up. There's a Chatango box right there.
I couldn't find it either. Thanks.
It's no problem. It's just on the website. If you go down, it just kind of appears, depending on what browser you're using, of course. But
so that's called TOB what?
TLBTownCrier.com. So. TLBTownCrier.com.
I put it in there for you, Dylan, too. TLB, except I've spelled it wrongly. You can cut and paste it when it's finished with it.
So, do you guys want to go back to the prison industrial complex?
Well, the reason why I introduced the idea of sociopaths into the conversation was that, of course, when we start to identify certain things as evil, there are plenty of things in this world that I consider to be evil without attaching the spiritual dogmas to it, let's just say. Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can say that, I don't know, throw something out there, Bill Gates is evil.
You just labeled it a dogma, Charles. Which fits dogma there?
Well, when you're talking about sin and what is actually a sin and missing the mark regarding the, the system of belief, let's just say, regarding what is right and wrong, this is a different thing. But there is a natural moral reaction to harm versus, you know, not harm. You know, there is positive and negative in the world, that is for sure. You know, and... Go ahead.
I just said, yeah. Yeah, there's things that will benefit us and things that won't benefit us, absolutely, for sure.
Right, and, it boils down very much to, in my opinion, there are plenty of things, like I said, that we can identify as evil in the world. I mean, regarding, harming of children... no matter what pleasure somebody derives from it. This is one of the things that, again, you know, I discussed recently on one of my shows. And, you can't come up with a justification there for calling it anything but evil, in my opinion. And I don't particularly subscribe to any organized religious belief or anything like that. I have a spiritual system of belief, which is unique to myself. But it doesn't necessarily... give black and white answers regarding what is right and wrong. They're just simply good things and bad things in the world, it seems to me, and we instinctively know that, regardless of how they're codified into writing or language or anything else. It doesn't require any of that. So that's just how I see it, mind you.
Well, they are sort of codified, but because what we're really saying, well, they're not codified, but what we are really saying there is that you have a loose system, but basically there's things that are good and things that are bad. So, like, there's positive and there's, you know, a positive action that gets a positive result and a negative action that gets a negative result. Would you say that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and one causes suffering and one causes not suffering.
Essentially, right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
And there's varying degrees to that. It's just the judgment is usually the problem. And, of course, I think that's what we were really talking about regarding, you know, judging individuals who happen to be in a position who are prisoners or whatever else as being less deserving of basic human rights than others. They may not be deserving of their freedom or all of the rights that, say, the rest of us are, but they're still not deserving of being, like, you know, lab rats or slaves or anything else any more than the rest of us are, in my opinion. But
yeah, I agree completely, and I think that's a really good segue back to where we began with the prison system. And so what we do is, particularly in a strong sort of Christian culture that we're living in, is that we say, well, look, you know, they're bad, and so we can put them in jail and we can exploit them, and that's exactly why we were examining how it is that we think we can think this way. And I think we've covered a fair bit of area that covers that we allow ourselves to be narrow-minded and judgmental because we don't look at it, you know, from a sociological perspective, how people are constructed and how they can be deconstructed and how our opinions are constructed and how opinions can be deconstructed so that we can get a more clear view.
Well, like recently, I was accused of not having a very clear view on capital punishment, because in theory, I agree with the idea of capital punishment. But at this point in time, because the state is so corrupt, because the courts are so corrupt, because individuals are so corrupt, I do not wish to entrust, you know, from my vote anyway, from my moral perspective, I don't wish to entrust the state with the power of life and death any more than they already have it. So in my opinion, it's illogical to support capital punishment if you believe that the state is ultimately corrupt. And I had people kind of go at me for that one, you know.
Really? I think it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, that line of reasoning is logical.
That's how I figure. It's very logical to assume that, you know, look, in an ideal society, if the government was truly looking out for my best interest, although by government by definition is not going to do so, if it was, and it truly did represent, you know, not necessarily the democratic point of view where you end up with an almost mob rules kind of sentiment, you know, in the government itself, but if it did truly reflect the beliefs and the desires of the public at large, then it might be a possibility to entrust them with such punishments and things. But in that same line of thinking, I think that
what do you think of this idea? Have the choice between life in prison and capital punishment up to the local people in that specific city.
Yeah, but see, again, to leave it up to public sentiment, again, trusts another, you know, system of dissemination of information to the public. You know, there are a lot of viewpoints that are, you know, say, put forth. Okay, take a look at this Michael Brown situation that we're looking at right now, right? You know, the whole thing near St. Louis there in Missouri. Public sentiment is not necessarily in the right place, depending on how the situation actually played out. And who are we going to rely on to disseminate that information to the public at large to allow them to say vote on what to do with this cop? It's impossible. You know, it's an impossible quandary at this point.
I can agree with you on that one. I haven't looked into it very much, but it was just an idea of mine. I didn't think it through very much.
No, it's okay, but in an ideal world where people were well informed, and again, the government could be trusted, and, you know, and Tinkerbell was a real person, you know, and the Easter Bunny came and gave us all chocolate eggs, you know, twice a year, it would be nice. But since that's not the reality we live in, you know, it seems to me as though, you know, if it's corrupt from top to bottom, then it can't be trusted from top to bottom, then I don't want to add my voice to the consenting voices of those that want to ascribe greater power to them, the power of life and death. It is already unfortunate that there is the power of life and death in the hands of governments and military elements and things like that that have absolutely nothing to do with my desires, my beliefs, or my willingness to defend myself, you know, on a daily basis as it is.
Well, so, it's also capital punishment is also based upon the premise that people can't change. And that's meaning that everybody, that means you're labeling everybody as an incurable psychopath.
Yeah, see, the thing is that this is why I say, again, you know, on a case-by-case basis, this has to be judged. There are individuals who are incapable of change, I believe.
I don't.
But at the same time, there are plenty of people that are quite capable of change.
If you're going to take that down to a brain science, then, you know, people obviously can reroute pathways in their brain, and they've proven scientifically that sociopaths can be trained in empathy now. It's a fact.
Mm.
They can light up those aspects of the, of the...
Yes, I'm not rude about them.
Yeah, but you can't force a sociopath to be anything but what they are. You know, you need the consent of that individual.
You're forced to kill them. Actually, that's an interesting thing. Did you know that when you're about to be killed, you actually have to step up and agree to be killed with capital punishment? There's that point. I just learned this from Vin recently, that in which the hangman says... step forwards, and when you step forwards, you're putting yourself into the hands of the person to kill you. So if you don't reach forwards, you step forwards, then you don't give them permission to kill you. But going back to where we were, I think if you think you finish the problem by killing the person, and you have that power, you've given the state the power to kill the person, then you could also use that same power to reprogram them.
Yeah, I don't believe in the forced re-education of people. I don't believe in rewiring somebody's brain. I think if they're going to change, they should do it on their own.
Well, if they're going to die, then they should die on their own, which is that theory you have to put yourself into the hands of the hangman to be killed. But Well, that's what Vin said.
I don't know. I've never heard of such a thing regarding American executions. I don't know about other places.
We have 1 minute left. You can find me and Jillian on People's Internet Radio. When is your show, Jillian?
I'm on Sunday night, straight after Vin. Midnight in Ireland, and in Australia it's 10 a.m. We've got daylight saving at the moment.
Okay, you can find me on there Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern. You can find me on Shake and Wake Saturdays. Wednesdays 4 to 6, Saturdays 5 to 7 Eastern. And you can also find me here 8 to 9 p.m. on Wednesdays. This is Shitsu Speaks. We will be back next week.
Trying to throw me under the bus, and guess what? I'm not going to be thrown there.
The problem with our country is we don't manufacture anything anymore.
Our nation's borders have become a revolving door for criminal, illegal aliens.
No, no, no! Not God bless America! God, I am America!
Have been a member of Trinity United Church of Christ since 1992. Known Reverend Wright for almost 20 years.
The credit downgrade by Standard & Poor's, one of three U.S. rating agencies, has generated 1,000 days without a budget.
Senator Clinton calling Senators Kerry and Obama elitist. It's plain politics. But why throw Gore under the bus?
Folks, you know, these days it seems like more and more people are just out for themselves. I gotta tell you, maybe because the outlook for the future is so uncertain. People can turn on you and act like they never even knew you. Just put right under the bus. There really seems to be no loyalty today. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. Just take a look at these stupid politicians, lost, scratching their heads in the kitchen. You'd think they were itching, fit to throw it all under the bus. You know what I'm talking about. It's really rough out here.